In medicine, as in art, a change of perspective can transform one's approach. In this podcast, you will meet someone who has approached supportive care in cancer from many perspectives of different professional roles and settings, with work as diverse as editing a textbook of supportive care and composing a musical. I'm Bogda Kozwara, and this is Supportive Care Matters. Today's conversation is sponsored by Canteen. My guest today is Professor Ian Olver. Ian is a professorial research fellow at the School of Psychology and adjunct professor at the School of Public Health at the University of Adelaide. Ian is a clinician, researcher, oncologist, and an ethicist with a long career in cancer care. He's also an avid traveler, a New York City marathon finisher, and an expert birthday cake maker. I suspect he has many, many other talents that I'm yet to find out about. Ian, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Doctor.
So, Ian, I've known you for many, many years, and I know that you've had a very diverse and rich professional career. So perhaps for the listeners, could you give us a brief recap of your professional experiences?
Yes, look, I trained as a medical oncologist, and that was the core of my career, if you like. But along the way, when I trained in Melbourne at the Alfred and at Peter Mac, then I went over to the University of Maryland Cancer Center in Baltimore for some 30 months and came back to Peter MacCallum. And when I came back, they wanted someone for their ethics committee and no one else would do it. So I put up my hand and they sent me off to a short course in bioethics. And that triggered off initially a master's and then a PhD in bioethics. So I crossed those disciplines and subsequently actually studied a bit of theology as well. So I have a number of different perspectives, but, you know, I thoroughly enjoyed being a medical oncologist and helped build up the Royal Adelaide Cancer Centre. But after I'd been in clinical medicine for 25 years, I had the opportunity to go and join as CEO Cancer Council Australia. And that got me into sort of public health and public policy. So it was a different aspect of cancer. And I found that absolutely fascinating. I miss clinical medicine, but I was engaged in so many interesting things about cancer policy and, if you like, putting in things that would help thousands of people at a time rather than one by one, that it made a fairly rich career out of it. Now, subsequently, I've taken positions more since I gave up clinical medicine with universities, both teaching to cancer and doing psycho-oncology research and also teaching ethics.
So that's an incredible, rich variety of professional perspectives, from medical oncology to NGO leader and ethicist. How do you see the value of these diverse perspectives? Why are they important?
I think crossing disciplines gives you a different perspective on things, and you can apply something that you've learned in one discipline to another that usually wouldn't be part of the mainstream of the other. And that applies both to your usual work, but it also applies to research as well. You can come up with quite rich research ideas if you cross disciplines, and they're new and they're innovative. So I think it does help you to innovate, to have a perspective from a totally different discipline. And what enamored me about ethics when I first started studying it has only been trained in the sciences before this. And here was a whole new way of looking at things and bringing those together. And we've done research in end-of-life issues. We've done research into informed consent and so on. But it just brings a richness to the work you're doing.
I recall when I was a medical student, there was actually a requirement at the university for students to undertake some study in humanities. But of course, these days, as the medical course is getting shorter and the amount of science that is required is increasing, it's much harder to do so. But I note that actually ethics in particular, bioethics, is very popular among oncologists, perhaps because of the importance of it in today's oncology practice, isn't it?
Yeah, look, I think they face ethical issues and they identify ethical issues throughout their practice, and they want perhaps a more structured way of thinking about them and dealing with them. And many medical courses have ethics to medical students, particularly in their early years and beyond, and I think they engage with that quite enthusiastically. That's what I've found.
It's quite interesting to reflect that your professional training was formerly in oncology and in bioethics, and yet you're currently thriving in the field of psycho-oncology and public health. And perhaps it's the more generic thing, skills of research and scientific inquiry that are actually relevant to those in sort of that potentially put you in a good position to be successful in those two relatively new disciplines.
Well, I sometimes ask the question whether I would have been better concentrating on the one thing and putting all effort into that. But the reality is, you know, I'd get interested in things and go off and explore them and then find that you could bring them together in either a piece of research or the way you structured patient care or something like that. So it's been, as I say, a rich source of experience which can cross the disciplines and enhance them when you do that. And that's why I've continued to do that through the career. And as opportunities have come up to do new things, but pretty much always related to cancer, and then I've taken that opportunity. And I look back and it's led to so many experiences, both in Australia and overseas, that even now when I'm not working full time, but I tend to take projects. So I'm doing a project at the moment looking at cancer services for Central Australia, for example, because I started the first oncology clinic in Alice Springs and now they're ready to take another jump. So it's those sort of things that keep me interested.
You've just reminded me that you bring not just professional diversity of experience, but also perspectives from very different settings. You've mentioned rural Australia and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders health, but also you've done some work internationally in India and elsewhere. Tell me about that and how these diverse perspectives can influence your practice and research.
First of all, both the Indian experience and the Alice Springs experience came from really chance encounters where people came into my office and said, in one case, could you do a clinic in Alice Springs? And one of the breast surgeons realized there was no medical oncology up there. And so I started doing a clinic fly in, fly out, and did it for about 13 years, I think. The Indian experience was soon after I moved to the Royal Adelaide, a neonatal specialist who was trained in Vellore, the big Christian Medical College hospital in Vellore in India, came to see me and said, look, my wife's just been treated for breast cancer in Adelaide, but if we'd been in India, there was no medical oncology at our hospital, and my batch group, my year group, has raised money to train someone. Would you do it? Well, I, of course, said yes. I went over to India and met the person. That was some 28 years ago. And I visited him many times since. And I was there a couple of months ago at his son's wedding, actually. And I looked at all the new facilities. And there are now a big new hospital that was started in April with 5 medical oncologists and 10 trainees. And that all started from this one poor individual who was trying to see hundreds of patients a week. But it gave me a perspective on resource allocation and how to try and get the principles that we thought were important about how to talk to patients, how to support patients into a setting where it was very difficult to do just because of the patient numbers. And I reorganized the clinic along lines I'd seen in America, where instead of the one trained oncologist trying to see all the patients, I put him at the head of the clinic, got all the registrars to actually see the patients and come to him for the one decision that he had to make that they didn't have the experience to make, and that was the treatment and talking about the more difficult things. And that meant that he or the clinics could get through a lot more patients that way, and that helped out a bit. And I once went over there and my colleague had developed TB, and he said, would you mind doing my morning clinic? And I found myself having to see 60 patients before lunch. And how do you communicate with people like that? Well, we did teach them about asking open-ended questions and so on, but I know at the time the registrars thought that I was incredibly slow and that they'd be there well into the night if I was let the way I usually do it.
I'm reflecting on the fact that what you're describing is also a legacy of many, many years of relationships. It's not like you sort of flew in offered your expertise and flew out. This is 20 years of experience working in India and over 20 years of developing oncology departments and one informing the other. So your diverse perspectives are not fleeting experiences. They're actually quite long-lasting. In fact, many of them you were running concurrently, weren't you, when you were busy as an oncologist and traveling to India at the same time?
I think you've hit on something very important, because it doesn't matter what I've done, you discover that the relationships underpin all of it. So it is a matter of continuity. It's the same with patient care. The patients that you have a long-term relationship with are far easier to treat because of that long-term relationship. It makes it easier to break bad news. It makes it easier to celebrate the joyous times with them. The same thing, of course, you've just mentioned in India, the same thing in Alice Springs. But interestingly enough, when I was doing a lot of sort of political advocacy with Cancer Council Australia, I discovered very soon it was building up a relationship with the politicians, the health minister of the day, that made the difference, not the particular advocacy agenda that you had. The fact that they knew you wouldn't come and waste their time, that you had something that was well worked out, and you were trying to look for something where you would forward your agenda and they could forward theirs. And so the relationship was the most important thing. So that's something that goes throughout all of the things you can do in cancer care and indeed supportive care.
So when you reflect on your experience of building relationships 20 years ago and now, are we doing it differently? Are we able to invest as much as we had before? Are we better at it, or perhaps maybe less attentive?
Well, I think in terms of supportive care, we're more aware that supportive care is important than we were 20, 30 years ago. But there are time and cost pressures today that are more acute than they were in those days. And that has led to perhaps a deterioration in the ability for individuals to form the same relationships, and you tend to rely on a team of individuals to look after a patient rather than trying to do it all yourself as you might have in the early days. I mean, in the early days of oncology, no one subspecialized because it was just general oncology. Now we're getting subspecialties. But again, I used to find it very useful to bring some learnings from one tumor type into another. And the same thing with research. You know, I wonder if adjuvant therapy will work as well in head and neck cancer as it does in breast cancer, things like that. So you're able, again, to look at a perspective beyond the particular area that you were practicing in. So it is more difficult these days. But on the other hand, there are things that are going to broaden the opportunity for relationships. And that's, of course, all the better communication techniques, video conferencing, podcasts, all that sort of thing, where you can get information out far more broadly, internationally, instantaneously. Now, although people say, well, it's not the same as face-to-face, yes, it's got its disadvantages, but it's also got tremendous advantages of not having to go to the expense of travel, but to be able to communicate and link people up electronically, if you like. And so as we've created a busier situation, we've also partly at least created the solution to it. So I think you've always got to work in the parameters you're given at the time, and it's really what you prioritise that's important. And so I think the important thing is 20 years later that more people are focusing on the need of the patient and supportive care.
So as you're thinking about the opportunities for supportive care looking into the future, what do you see as the main opportunities? I know that you are an author of the Multinational Association of Supportive Care in Cancer textbook of supportive care and survivorship. When you edit your next edition of the textbook, what will be the most important chapter to write that is yet to be written?
Oh, look, I think there are some new things that are happening that will help us along the way. So, for example, digital databases that can pull in all the data from the literature and marry it through an AI mechanism with particular patient information will help us deal with, you know, pharmacogenomics to be able to better select our supportive care drugs, just like we are targeting our cancer drugs. And because there is so much information once you get into genomics, we're going to need those sort of new structures to be able to bring all the patient data together and be helped in making the best decisions. So we've got, you know, a brave new world of AI, and it's got its issues, and there's plenty of ethical issues to solve. But we're developing tools that will enable us to develop more patient-centered care in a more efficient way if we use them properly.
So let's just pick up on that and some of the ethical challenges of the big data and technology and AI. What springs to mind is issues of access and equity and representation. Are these the main ethical challenges, or are there different challenges that I haven't considered?
I think you're quite right that as we bring in sort of more high-tech things, there's always the issue of equity, and equity even now. I mean, there are some countries that don't have good access to morphine, for example, so we've still got a long way to go in that. But one of the big issues is the patient acceptability of AI. So, for example, if you have an AI device that you write your algorithms, you teach it on data sets of what to do, and then you let it do its deep learning as it accumulates more and more data, you actually lose control about how it makes decisions because it's now effectively learning itself. Now, will patients, A, like their data going into that system, and how well will they respond to, well, this is the decision out the other end, but we can't tell you how we got there? And so patients, you know, will have to be comfortable. And I'm not suggesting AI will replace doctors, but even the doctor may not know how the AI made the decision. And it may actually make a decision that is different from what you would expect. So for just to give an example, if you had some sort of AI analyzing mammograms, and you decided that the thing that was most important was that there weren't any false positives, for example, but the AI, as it learnt, decided that it would emphasize false negatives, you'd get a completely different answer. And if you're trying to get rid of any false negative, I mean, you might have overdiagnosis, all those things may happen. The other problem we have with AI is at the moment what's happening is that people are comparing AI to the accuracy of a clinical decision, either a radiologist or a practicing clinician. And they're saying, oh, you know, AI picked up more of those and more of this. The real thing is, did it make a difference to the endpoint of patient care? And we haven't seen enough research into what happens to the patient after that. Was the fact that more positive mammogram, was that a good thing or a bad thing, or didn't it make any difference at all to survival? Did it subject people to procedures they didn't need to have? So we've really need to make sure that AI is delivering the endpoint of good clinical care rather than whether it's better at diagnosing or certainly better at being able to suck in all the details of genomics and so on to make decisions. So they're the things that I think about as the next step for AI. And I'm not against it at all. I think it could be a very important tool, but we need to take into account those things.
Well, you're presenting a very compelling argument for AI as a tool that changes the distribution of power in the therapeutic relationship, because really the role of AI and role of this approach is dependent on how acceptable it is to a patient or patients as a group. And that means that the decision process of how the interventions are developed, designed, implemented rests not just within the health professionals, but also requires a role of the patients. So how can we bring the patients into that discussion? How can we make them part of the solution development?
Well, I mean, they need to be brought in as early as possible, like before now, if possible. And some of them are, to be honest, but they need to be part of the development of these things. So the people who are developing it need to upskill consumers about what this is and what the use of it is. And in terms of clinicians, it will be a tool to help them make a decision, not make the decision for them. I think that's the real thing. And we've got to solve the problems that this patients may ask. So, for example, what happens when something goes wrong? Who do you blame? Do you blame the AI? Do you blame the people who programmed the AI? Do you blame the whole team? Because the law isn't used to having something like that. Do you make AI into a sort of a person so that they can be held accountable? I mean, all those things are things that people will ask. And I think we need to solve them before there's the widespread use. And we simply need to get patient consent before we use it, or before even before their data is used in a learning set. And that hasn't happened to date. You know, large amounts of data have been given by various agencies to train your AI on, but the patients that put that data in aren't usually consulted. So I think we need to go back to saying the patient's at the centre of this, and they need to, even if they don't understand, and I don't by any means understand all the neural networks and how AI works, even if they don't understand that, they've got to be comfortable that it's being properly regulated, I think.
Indeed. I mean, there are many clinical encounters these days with conventional healthcare delivery where patients may not understand the intricacies of how things are done or how the surgery is performed, for example, but they still are expected to voice their preferences and decisions about how they will be involved in it and what their potential consequences might be. And I would imagine the principles here are the same, except that the challenge is that the discussions need to occur not just at the individual patient level, but also at the more conceptual societal level, because the data in many ways involves the population level data as well as individual patients' data. So I think we need to build systems and frameworks to engage society as a whole, patients, healthcare providers, policymakers, payers, to discuss these issues.
That's right. And at the end of the day, as you know, many patients accept treatment because they trust their doctor, not because they understand all the ins and outs and what the alternatives are. The question is, if you bring AI into the mix, can you get the same degree of confidence of the patient that will allow that to happen?
I think you're just saying, can you trust the algorithm?
Well, even if you trust the algorithm, can you trust the learning beyond the algorithm when the deep learning from the data that goes on after the learning set?
Yes, and I would imagine it's only if you can trust whoever wrote the algorithm. At the end of the day, there is a person behind every algorithm, isn't it?
Yeah, but can you trust the fact that they've tested it properly to make sure that the output for you is likely to be beneficial? That's where the trust will have to be. And they'll have to produce the data that their particular device, if you like, does deliver.
I'm incredibly reassured by the fact that at the end of the day, when we're talking about technology and algorithms and AI, the key issue is trust, which is fundamental and has been around for such a long time. So we're back into the very beginning and to the fundamentals of what makes for good medical practice. Yes. So I just want to switch gear for a second and explore some of those different perspectives on a more personal note from you. As I think about changes of career from oncologist to leader of the NGO and the researcher, and you've also changed locations, geography, etc., it takes a lot of courage to change perspectives and change the skill set and enormous amount of trust in the future and determination. What helped you build such a rich career without having too many moments to agonize about it? Or maybe you did have moments of agonizing.
Well, you know, I obviously had a very supportive family for some of those changes. I also have a faith that says to me that I am where I'm meant to be and I'm given opportunities that I'm meant to take. And so, yes, it was a great deal of change is always difficult, and dramatic change, like going from clinical medicine, which was probably the biggest jump I made. But I suppose once you've done it once and you look back, say, 6 months, 12 months later and say, gee, that was a good decision, glad I made that one, then it's easier the second time. And so when opportunities come up that look truly exciting, you take them. So it's almost a learned behaviour, I think. And at the beginning of my career, I would have never predicted that I would be like that.
You know, I only had a conversation with some of the junior doctors that work with me today, and I recall how many of them were worried about what the future will hold, whether there will be jobs for them and whether they can sustain themselves in their predictable career path. And your story is just so incredibly reassuring that things happen that you possibly couldn't imagine, but they're good things and exciting things, aren't they?
Yeah, look, I've always reassured people that right throughout time, when I went across to America, for example, there were no jobs in Australia. I mean, the first wave of oncologists had come back. But what happened? They all set up the units start growing, and then they needed a second oncologist and a third oncologist and so on. So there were jobs available by the time my training was finished. In fact, I knocked back the first job I was offered, which was really because it may have meant I'd stayed in America forever, but very soon after a job that I thought was ideal came up, and I came back to Australia. So I think people have worried about it, but my experience would say that the opportunities will come if you can recognize them and if you're prepared to take them.
Yes, I believe there is still no jobs, but for some reason everybody seems to be employed, so I think we're okay.
Yes,
now,
that's right.
I can't resist, but I want to ask you to share the story of you writing a musical, because this is truly an example of courage and determination. So can you tell us how you wrote a musical and how you actually went about it?
Every so often when you do things, you discover that you can actually do them. And I discovered I could write lyrics. I'm not particularly music. I can write a tune, but I can't score it and so on. But so I used to do a lot of long-haul flights, and I was doodling one day, and the first line of a song came to me, and I wrote the verse, and then I wrote the song, and I wrote 13 others, and that became a musical. And then when we set up the oncology unit in Vellore, my trainee knew that I'd been doing this, so he emailed me one day and said, look, when you come to the opening of this thing, there'll be an opening ceremony, there'll be a concert, but at night we like to put on a performance. Did you ever finish that thing? And I said, yes, so I sent it over. And so my first experience of anything being performed was in this big 1,000-seat hall with 50 in the cast, an orchestra, and the graduating school of nurses had choreographed, they'd painted backdrops and costumes and things like that. And it was an enormous thrill to have something that was just in your head performed by others. And even if they performed it in a completely different way sometimes than you'd envisaged, it was just great fun to do. And I've written things, again, songs and things mainly for church and so on, but it's just something you discover, you do it, but discovered by chance, really.
I think it's an amazing story, an amazing testament to your talent. And I hope that we'll get to see the musical maybe again somewhere here. I don't know whether we can match the backdrop and the size of the auditorium, but we can try.
Well, I put it on once as a concert version to raise money at the local church in Adelaide. So we have done it here without all the backdrops and things, but this was many years ago now.
I cannot think of many oncologists who managed to write a musical somewhere between writing an NHMRC grant application.
Well, it's very interesting because a lot of oncologists do creative things, and there are a lot of oncologists who are actually musicians, which I'm not. And I think they need a creative outlook, and so they pick up those things. So I've come across a lot of oncologists who write novels and so on. They don't tell you about it till you're having a coffee late at night or something like that, but there's a lot of people that think that medicine is fairly predictable in the way it's practiced, and so they look for an outlet beyond that.
Which really highlights that in our professional roles, we need something that sustains us, that goes beyond the predictable and routine, and something that is very creative. And you've mentioned a number of things already that are important in your life. So what are the most important things that sustain you?
Oh, well, I think my family does. There's no doubt about that. They've been very supportive and, you know, delighted in what my sons are doing and now my grandkids are doing. My faith has been important to me. I did train as a lay preacher, and I do that occasionally around Adelaide, and that gives me access to a whole lot of really interesting people that I wouldn't have met otherwise, and gets me to think about some of the deeper things like how we should behave towards each other and what, in fact, will lead to the richness of the life we want to have. So those sort of things are important. But I've also been curious, and I've also been prepared to follow things that interest me. And that might mean going down rabbit holes that you don't expect, but I've always enjoyed doing that, and I've never allowed either my career or myself to be stuck in a corner somewhere. So if something is finishing, it's important to know how to start things. It's important to also know when to finish things, because you hear of a lot of people burning out or just becoming a little bit hard-hearted towards what they're doing, and that's because they've been doing it for too long and haven't explored other things that they're just as talented at doing that could sustain their interest.
Ian, you've given me and to all the listeners very good lessons on what rich, fulfilling and impactful professional career is all about. So to finish off, I'd like to ask you one question in sort of two parts. Conventionally, I try to ask all my guests of why supportive care matters, but I'd like a small twist on it. Perhaps if you could also add why supporting oneself matters for those who look after patients with cancer.
So to answer the last question first, supporting oneself is about having the relationships where other people will support you and you'll support other people. So it goes back to our relationship thing again. Don't try and be a sole agent. Make sure that all the people around you, you're prepared to support and they'll be prepared to support you. And I can't sort of overemphasize that because it's been important. The question about why supportive care matters, I think the real thing with supportive care is that it focuses you on the experience of the patient. It puts that front and center. And I think that's the important thing that becoming involved in supportive care does. So whatever the other things are, you're trying to treat their disease, you're doing that, you've got to make sure right now they're as well as they can be. So we talk about patient-centered care, but supportive care is a key to that in cancer because it's actually forcing you to put the patient experience at the center of your care.
I can't think of a wiser way to finish the podcast. Ian, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you, Bogda.
That is all for Supportive Care Matters, a podcast created by me, Bogda Kozwara, for researchers, clinicians, policymakers, and patients passionate about improving the lives of people affected by cancer. Thanks to Mark Tai, who composed the original music, the Oncology Network, our producers, and Canteen, our sponsors. For show notes, go to www.oncologynews.com.au. Subscribe to this podcast at your favorite podcast provider and rate us. It will help others find us.